the 15th anniversary of 9/11, as probably most of you know. I have to say, just a slight aside, when I saw the schedule of teachers and I saw that I had 9/11, I was like, why do I have to get this date? So I had Mother's Day. So I don't. My personal preference, I would rather not teach on like the holidays, because it feels like there's some charge there, or I should move in this direction. The talk should be about this topic or that one. So I wasn't super excited about it, but so it goes. So it goes. So anyway, I'll be talking a little bit about 9/11 this evening, and more so about kind of symbolically about that date, and also kind of what it has to offer us in terms of learning about forgiveness. So for many of us in the U.S., it was a time when we lost that kind of, that really kind of false sense of invulnerability that we had as Americans, you know. We may have had a sense of vulnerability for ourselves as individuals, but it seemed like as a country it was kind of unquestioned that would never happen on our soil, that something like that wouldn't. So there was really we were really kind of exposed to the reality that this can happen to us too, that we're not immune from that. And the events brought up all kinds of emotions and still may. I think one thing that's important to acknowledge from a Dharma perspective is that the events of that day arose due to causes and conditions. Just as with all other conditioned things, this was a conditioned arising as well. And all of the events of that day and of that period, the most malicious ones, the desire to cause great harm, and the most generous acts of caring for others and reaching out to see if others are okay. And I'm not suggesting that this only happened inside of the U.S. or only with people of certain religious groups or anything like that at all. I had heard this quote from Jack Kornfield many years ago that some of you may well have heard from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was a Soviet dissident and spent many years in the Gulag and the prisons there, and the labor camps. And this quote, and I think the quote was cleaned up to kind of remove the sexist language, but this is it essentially. If only it were so simple. If only there were truly evil people somewhere, and it were simply necessary to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of their own heart? You know, this is not, this is something that happens around the world. Even in, we primarily practice in the Theravadan Buddhist lineage here, which comes primarily from Burma and Thailand and Sri Lanka. And a lot of times we can see some of these countries as really wonderful, or there can be this projection onto them of this certain qualities that we want to see there. But even in a country like Burma, which can be so wonderful in so many ways, the Muslim people there can be treated horrifically. The Rohingya people have been really, the government said something like maybe they're not treated, even though they were born there and have lived there for hundreds of years, they are not Burmese. Mm-hmm. And the Burmese won't even allow Doctors Without Borders to treat them. So there are many ways, a very large, grand scale, and on a really small scale, that we make certain either individuals or certain groups of people other. Right? So I'm just noticing that. We may be able to, we may have been a victim of this, or this may have been in the past for our family of having been treated this way based on our ethnic or religious identification. And or there could be really, it could happen on a really large scale, or it could be on a really small scale, the ways in which we are made to feel other, and the ways in which we treat other people as other. Just noticing how that is for you. And then around forgiveness, I was assisting Philip Moffitt on a day long at Spirit Rock several years ago. It may have been 6 or 8 years ago, something like that. And myself and the other people assisting had broken the whole group into smaller groups. So Philip had one group, and then the other assistants, we each had smaller groups. And we're doing kind of some Q&A with people. Someone asked a question about forgiveness. And I gave an answer about it as best I could. And it seemed to work for that person. They seemed to be resonating with it. And that was that. And then after that kind of breakout group ended, someone came up to me and said, but this doesn't apply to this thing. And he told me a little bit about this experience in his life. It doesn't apply to this, does it? And, he had been sexually abused as a child. So there was, not by a family member, but by some authority figure. So there was a really, really major betrayal there. And it does apply to that. It applies to that and to all situations. What it doesn't do is it doesn't have a demand about what that looks like and in what time frame that happens. It does not mean pardoning another person's actions, and it doesn't mean that someone doesn't face the consequences of their actions. What it does mean is it says something about our own desire, our own longing for our hearts to be free, for our hearts to be free, not those of the offender or the abuser or whoever. So how do we hold this person? How do we hold this possibility? How does this person who I was talking with at that day long, how does he hold that possibility for the person that sexually abused him? When he was just a child. As Philip has said, initially we may not be able to forgive, but it's enough that we can wish that we could forgive. And if we can't do that, it's enough that we could wish that we wished that we could forgive, and so on, right? It's enough to hold that. Those layers can go away over time, and with practice, they can do that. And a significant part of the journey of forgiveness involves compassion. Compassion for those who caused us harm and compassion for ourselves, for the state that we find ourselves in. Just for this, just for the experience of our lives, for the way that we screwed that thing up, for the way that person mistreated us and how that affected things in our lives and it might have turned out differently otherwise. Bell Hooks, who's a feminist scholar and social activist, in her book Killing Rage, Ending Racism, said, for me, forgiveness and compassion are always linked. How do we hold people accountable for wrongdoing and yet at the same time remain in touch with their humanity enough to believe in their capacity to be transformed? I can remember around the time of 9/11 coming to the to Marin Sangha. I guess it was San Rafael Sangha at the time. We met at this yoga studio right across the street from United Market, and we did a ritual that night. And everybody took these stones just kind of held these stones for kind of, people could take them and get rid of them that evening, or could keep them with themselves. I still have mine on my altar. I noticed it recently. But some way, and I remember Philip talking about how he said he thought there were acts that were unforgivable, but he didn't think that there were beings who were unforgivable, because he wanted to allow for that possibility of redemption. Why does that happen? You know. And we might be in a place in our lives right now where we do not want to hold that possibility of redemption for somebody, or that possibility of forgiveness. And that's okay for right now. I'm sure some of you may have heard this story before. In Cambodia, during the period of the killing fields, something like 50% of the country, 50% of the people in the country were killed by the Khmer Rouge primarily. Monks and nuns were slaughtered. And then after Vietnam invaded towards the end of that time and drove out or subdued the Khmer Rouge or significantly hindered them, and Mahakosananda, a senior monk from Cambodia, he would go to refugee camps around in the border areas between Thailand and Cambodia, sharing teachings, you know, which was his first time really being able to share teachings in many years. And he had lost most of his family of origin, and many of his brothers and sisters in robes. And he would bring chant sheets with him, with a verse from the Dhammapada about how hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. Many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize this, quarrels end. So we would bring these and go out here. People would start doing this chanting, and people would just be crying. So much collective grief there. Yeah. So that's it, farther away from home. And closer to home, we see many of these acts as well. I know I was just recently, Alton Sterling, who had been selling CDs outside a convenience store in Baton Rouge, and who got into an altercation with the police, and they had him on the ground, and then shot him and killed him. Seeing this video of his son offering forgiveness for his father being killed. 15-year-old son, you know. Or the parishioners at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. They were killed by somebody who came to their Bible study with them. You know. On June 21st of this year, which was the anniversary, in honor of the 9 people who were killed, the church asked people to perform an act of kindness as Acts of Amazing Grace Day and share that deed on their Facebook page. And they said in one of the announcements, it said, "With thousands of acts of grace being performed around the world, we will surely make the world a better place." I mean, to me, that just seems kind of amazing that people could respond in that way. When I have a hard time forgiving, you know, somebody for, you know, what, taking my lane on the street, you know. We all have our opportunities to practice, huh? But this does run through the teachings of the Buddha. This is part of the teachings, and we see it reflected in many ways. And one way we'll even see it in the chants, in many of the chants that are done, even in simple ways. There's one chant called the Sharing of Blessings, and that is a kind of dedication of merit that is done. It's not when we do the Buddha's words on kindness or on loving kindness, that's actually was one of the discourses of the Buddha. This one is, while it's not one of those, it does exist at many monasteries throughout Southeast Asia. Sometimes the wording will change a little bit from place to place. And I want to just read a little bit of that to you. Through the goodness that arises from my practice. Well, and traditionally I'll be done kind of at the end of the day. It's really a wonderful thing. I did this for some time in the evening at the even if I only sat for 10 minutes in the evening, I would do this at the end of that thing. A wonderful way, great way to do a tuck-in for yourself here. Highly recommended. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. That's kind of about the first half of it there. So I mean, it starts off in a way that's maybe easier to connect to for some. We're talking about spiritual friends, teachers. For some of us, parents and relatives may be a little tricky, a little stumbling. But sun, moon, virtuous leaders, the highest gods. Okay, you know, maybe we can take all of that and we can take some of that. But then it really takes a significant turn. Evil forces, the Lord of death, those who are... not just those who are friendly, but those who are indifferent, those who are hostile. You know, this is our practice. This is what the Buddha was teaching. And my initial reaction to this when I heard this was a little displeasure. You know, I mean, I didn't want to open to evil forces. You know, what? I mean, I'm working hard here to do good. Well, what, I want to share this with them out there, you know? Remember that Solzhenitsyn quote about the, mm-hmm. Okay. You know, and on one level, and then I kind of turned a little corner internally, and it sounded like it was okay, you know, okay, yeah, I could see that, get behind offering my blessings to someone who was hostile. But then somebody does something that feels mean to me. And then I didn't want to be, you know, it's like some generic hostile being. It's fun. But this person who had been mean to me and said that thing to me there, and people laughed, I'm not offering any blessings to them. Yeah. But... and then, you know, at times I was moved by the general idea, but it would still be a little disconnected. It wasn't quite fully connected to the reality of people, you know, and the fact that this all beings means really all beings, you know. I mean, it's not getting to choose, you know. That's really what it is about, not getting to choose. Ajahn Sumedho, who is a monk in the Thai forest lineage and is one of Philip's two teachers. I heard him say in a talk that it's easy to do loving kindness for all beings if you're just saying it for all beings everywhere. But it's harder to do it when you're thinking of these specific difficult beings. Yeah. And I've definitely found that to be the truth, to be the case. Probably all bumped up against that one. Yeah. Maybe not. If you haven't, that's great. That's a tremendous blessing right there. But this is our practice, to continually open to more and more beings. to work with our hearts so that no beings are excluded. Once again, just a reminder, this is not about not having safe boundaries and not about keeping yourself safe and protected. So this may seem really lofty and unattainable. It may seem like something that you hear it, but you don't want to go there at this point. And that's okay. We can simply work with the fact of where we are right now. Yeah, of where our heart is right now. That's what things like forgiveness practice, what the loving kindness practice, compassion practice, really present us with that opportunity to see where we're getting stuck. Where is it that our hearts do not open? Where do they get stuck? Where is it that, well, give some metta, but not too much? You know, where is that? And that's just the place where we work at. That's the edge of our practice, right there. It's not so much about fixing those stuck places. It's about bringing mindfulness and kindness and compassion to those places. We can't force ourselves to open, and we don't want to. So you may have your list of people you consciously exclude. Perhaps some political leaders. Anyone? Political candidates. You may have them on one side or the other, or both sides, or multiple sides. I was assisting Philip at another day long earlier this year, just a few months ago, something like that. And he was talking about his practice of compassion for our presidential candidates. And he was just very genuine about that, and really hearing him talk about it, I didn't detect any sense of any sense of superiority, any sense of separation. There was no kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, well, we know what this person's doing. There was nothing like that. It was really about actually meeting these people with compassion. Extremely inconvenient. Very true. Yeah. So I'm sure that you've all heard some very powerful stories about forgiveness. And I was looking up some stories about restorative justice in preparation for this talk. And if you want any more inspirational stories about forgiveness or anything like that, they're out there. They're out there. Go to Google or YouTube, and you could just type mother, father, daughter, son forgives blank, whatever, killer, anything like that, and find all kinds of remarkable stories. So really, very, very inspiring, very touching. So here's an excerpt of one that I read about. And this was from a story that was on StoryCorps, which is how StoryCorps, maybe the organization which collects stories in audio, so you can go listen to them. It would be easy, expected even, for Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel to be enemies. After all, he killed Johnson's only son in 1993. He went to prison for that. And toward the end of his sentence, he and Johnson made peace. As a teenager in Minneapolis, Israel was involved with gangs and drugs. One night at a party, he got into a fight with Laramian Bird, 20, and shot and killed him. O'Shea is now 34. He finished serving his prison sentence for murder about a year and a half ago. Israel recently visited StoryCorps with Johnson to discuss their relationship and the forgiveness it is built upon. As Johnson recalls, their first face-to-face conversation took place in Stillwater Prison when Israel agreed to her repeated requests to see him. Quote, "I wanted to know if you were in the same mindset of what I remembered from court, where I wanted to go over and hurt you," Johnson tells Israel. "But you were not that 16-year-old. You were a grown man. I shared with you about my son. And he became human to me," Israel says. At the end of their meeting at the prison, Johnson was overcome by emotion. "The initial thing to do was just try and hold you up as best I can," Israel says. "Just hug you like I would hug my own mother." Johnson says, "After you left the room, I began to say, I just hugged the man that murdered my son. And I instantly knew that all that anger and animosity, all the stuff I had in my heart for 12 years for you, I knew it was over, that I had totally forgiven you." And the story goes on from there. And he now lives next door to her. Now he's been released from prison. And she says, "I treat you as I would treat my son. And their relationship is beyond belief." Yeah. So mostly I've talked about forgiving others. However, as many of us know, there's another person who's often more difficult to forgive than others. And that's ourselves. For many of us, this one is the hardest one. Yeah. But this practice would not be complete without forgiving ourselves, without doing that as well. For all of the ways in which we think we have messed things up, for all the ways in which we feel like we've acted clumsily, or in all the ways in which we've caused great harm or small harm. It's important that we do that, that we cultivate that, that we cultivate that sense of forgiveness. When, and there are, I don't actually have a copy of the phrases with me here, but I'll say them. I'll say one version of them aloud now, so that if you want to work with them, you can. It's a very valuable practice to do. And it starts generally by asking for forgiveness from others. And just, you may ask for forgiveness from others externally, but it's more about saying it internally as your own practice. "For any harm I may have caused others, through thoughts or words or actions, intentionally or unintentionally, please forgive me." We can say these phrases, we can say this over and over. And then just, you can call to mind specific things that you have done. It could be small things or larger things. "For any harm I may have caused others, thought or word or action, intentionally or unintentionally, please forgive me." And then we turn it around. "For any harm others have caused me, in thought or word or action, intentionally or unintentionally, I forgive you as best I am able. And lastly, to ourselves, for any harm I may have caused myself in thought or word or action, intentionally or unintentionally, I forgive myself as best I'm able. As best I'm able, that is one of Philip's teachings, as many of you know. So useful to have that. We don't get to demand what it's going to look like and how the change is going to happen and what time frame. We're simply doing it as best we're able. As best we're able in this moment, right now. And when we are forgiving others, when we're asking forgiveness from others, in a very significant way, we're really doing this for our own benefit. Well, we do benefit tremendously. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like we'll go out and we'll get the good benefit now. That's why I'll do it. What I wanted to say is that through doing it, we genuinely and often greatly benefit ourselves from doing this practice. It can allow us the possibility to reduce or even stop holding some of the resentment or anger or ill will or sense of injustice that we have that hinders us in some way. So you can take it on as a deliberate practice. You can have it be something that you do every day for 5 minutes at the beginning of your practice or the end of your practice. And that would be kind of on a more formal way. In our daily lives, we can offer it silently to people who are problematic for us. The neighbor who always wants to talk, the person at work who, never does their share of the work and always takes more than their share of the credit, whoever. We can practice this there. And once again, without pardoning their actions, and not, it doesn't mean that we don't hold them accountable or that we don't take action to change things. And there are, you can do different tricks so that you can, if you have a hard time with people, just see this being. They were a child of somebody at one point in time. They're a child of somebody. They have a mother or parents who love them. Or worse, who didn't love them, who didn't give them enough love. So it can bring that compassion for ourselves so we can have that available to us. And really, we have these reactions that arise, throughout our days. And they arise due to causes and conditions. And with our intentions and with our actions, we're always creating new ones. What do we want those new ones to be like? Practicing with forgiveness is another way to take a step in that direction of really of looking at our own long-term well-being and happiness and the well-being and happiness of others and seeing the interrelatedness of that. So, thank you. questions or comments?
This is more of a comment than I notice that when I think about forgiving someone and I really reflect on the action that that person has done, and usually it's somebody in my family or very close to me, and I really reflect on that, I realize that there are two of us involved. That it's not always the person's actions. And I have to really question my own conscience and say, what did I do to precipitate this action, if anything at all? So I ask forgiveness and I give forgiveness, and it seems to work for me under those circumstances.
Yeah. And you bring up family, how it's usually a family or often a family member.
Or a close friend, friend, or
yeah.
Somebody that
I know. I just want to say, I've always said this, you know, we start easy. Start with the easy things to forgive. You know, families are like PhD level practice. You know, when it comes to affairs of the heart, and dealing with conflict, forgiveness, kindness, compassion, families are really, you know, that's challenging practice. It's challenging practice. So you want to take a very long-term approach there. And then sometimes things can really change. I mean, I know one family member who I can sometimes find difficult, when this person does some things, I can find myself, well, look at what they did, and what is this, and why didn't they do such and such, and why did they do that way? And they may have acted unskillfully. They may genuinely have acted in a way that was unskillful. Of course, it's also possible that they simply tripped over some wound that I have. You know, it's lying there like a cord that's, you know, along the floor or something like that. You know, maybe I have too many cords that I'm leaving out on the floor. But I've noticed that there can be a real difference for me when I frame it that way. And there can be a tendency to, I don't know if it's just a habit pattern to go down that road of wanting to get into this blamey place towards this one family member. And when I simply, when I can make that turn internally, it just makes it so much easier for me. It's just such a relief. So thank you for your comment and reminder. Yes.
This is just something that when you were talking about September 11th attacks.
Could somebody bring that?
So when you were talking about the September 11th attacks, am I getting feedback here?
No,
you'll be fine.
It's okay. I just started to ponder about this, and not comparing practices like forgiveness or loving kindness. But one of the things that occurs to me is that our Dharma practice is always about paying attention to what's true in the moment. And sometimes, especially when it's something like September 11th, to many of us who were not immediately affected because we lived so far away, I guess what I'm saying is it seems to me that it's important to process the feelings that you're feeling. So yes, this brings a lot of pain and anger. And I do have all these emotions, and not to just immediately jump to forgiveness if it's the right thing to do in the right time. But anyway, these are just thoughts, so maybe you have some comment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, it does happen in its own time. There's the little thing right above the green dot. You push that. it has to happen in its own time. And we do have to feel whatever feelings are present for us in a given experience. Whether it's 9/11 or something with some traumatic situation that happened in childhood or as an adult, or something that wasn't necessarily traumatic but that was painful nonetheless. I think it's very important to be skillful about how we work with the emotions. So thank you for bringing that up, because I don't want to suggest that, skirt away from that and go straight to forgiveness. We don't want to do that. That's a bypass, and that will create problems further down the road. Yeah. Did that help? Yeah,
I was just thinking out loud, really.
Children about our heart is all in our heart is always is often inconvenient, mm-hmm. but it comes to me, all in my mind mm-hmm. is often more inconvenient.
Mind, well, actually, in Pali, the language in which the Theravada tradition comes out of, the word chitta is translated as either mind or heart. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, really kind of the same thing, the thinking, the cognitive mind, and the affective part as well. So,
I guess I'm suggesting my mind gets me in more mischief. My mind is the reactive, my heart I trust,
uh-huh.
My mind is
uh-huh.
where I take off.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Sometimes I think we just need to allow time to be with the heart, be with the emotions that come up there, so that we don't get into this reactive place. And as we can do that, then we can be more responsive and less prone to being reactive in certain ways. So, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about blame and how easy it is?
How easy it is to... almost do it humorously sometimes, or do it in a way like, well, I just have to get this out here, either in my mind or actually saying it. I'm thinking about a fellow who took the wrong turn and didn't follow me when we were in a row, and finally he showed up, he and his friend, and he said, oh, so we're going to play the blame game, huh? And I really thought about it, and I thought about how quick I can be, even in a fairly innocuous situation, to bring up the blame game.
Uh-huh.
So I wondered if you'd ponder that.
So my experience with blame, because I'm with you, girl. I'm a blamer. I'm a blamer. It has caused certain problems in certain relationships in my life. And in my experience, so you know that part, kind of the inner judge. Some people call it the inner critic or whatever. That judging mind, yeah, that's, you know, could be self-judgmental. In my experience, blaming is simply that turned outward. Yeah. And as I start to pay attention to that more, it has kind of a similar energetic feel to it. I think you'll probably... with a little bit of time, you may recognize that. Check it out. See if that's true for you. I don't know. It's for me, it's often some smaller part of me that very much matters about who's right and who's wrong. You know, it's not about, it's not... The value is not about peace or harmony or friendship or relationship. It's about, you know, it goes back to, you know, I'm right, me. So see if that's there. And then, regardless of whether that's there or some other aspect of yourself, some young part or something like that, a lot of compassion. Just a lot of compassion for that one. Oh, here I am blaming again. Oh, little one, it's going to be okay. Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
button.
Green button?
Yeah.
Green,
the brown thing.
It's only green when it's on.
Oh. Okay, I got it.
Oh, wonderful.
To me, I think blaming has something to do with the need for control and the feeling of fear. That if you can blame someone, it's suddenly neat. Oh, this person is to blame, so I can fix it. Mm-hmm. And the compassion comes out of seeing, you know, feeling for your own fear and your own need to fix things. As well as to, you know, enhance the self and all the other things.
We have multiple microphone runners tonight.
I can relate to blaming big time, and the inner critic big time, but it's so out of control, some of my blaming, that, I mean, I can go on a blaming rant, and I don't even know what I'm blaming anymore, and it's almost without self. It's just almost like a tape going on, blaming, and myself isn't even there. And if when I can get in touch with that, there's some freedom in that.
Well, you know, Philip often talks about how we have kind of this committee inside us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we all know the committee, yeah. So I would recommend just kind of looking and seeing, who is that committee member? Who is that committee member who's blaming and just goes on the rant? You know, who is that one? Who is that Tom there? You know, maybe it's, you know, Mr. Bossy Pants, Mr. Always Right, you know, it could be like your dad or your grandfather or your mother or your brother, you know, whoever. But just see, who is that one who is doing the blaming? And what is that, what's the energy like in that place? What is it like to be in that place? Is it pleasant? Is it enjoyable? And not to blame that place. But just to see it, just to know that experience more fully. And over time, I think we can all develop more compassion and a greater ability to be with experience as it is. We can really just see kind of all these committee members, you know, wait a minute, who's grabbing the microphone now? And wait, pay attention to me over here, you know. That's kind of, to a big extent, my experience of the self, you know. People fighting over who gets the gavel, you know. It's me. Yeah. So
I think blame comes a lot from cultural shame and the inability for us to reflect and say, how did I participate? What did I contribute? How did I collude? Because we live in a culture that wants to punish and put people in jail, put you in the back of the room. And so it's so fearful to say, well, I participated and I contributed this much. And so it's so much easier to blame another person and sort of absolve yourself from any responsibility. And I think also the word accountability, which you used earlier, doesn't come up enough, where we can express our needs and our feelings and ask somebody to hear it and be accountable. Without shame, and it takes the blame out of it. I don't know if what I said just made sense because my thoughts weren't well organized, but I hope it did.
Okay. Well, that's about, I think that's all we have time for right now. We're going to have to go into doing our metta practice.
Do you want to chant first or later?